This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and today we're going to be talking about what's new and what's working in energy finance. And Jeff, why don't you go ahead and talk about it for a while here, get things started.
Okay.
Jeff Hinsky. Yeah. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
So this is Jeff Hinsky. I'm the VP of Policy and New Markets at Clean Focus. And effectively what that means I'm responsible for here is, you know, kind of keeping the landscape out there in the North America, primarily United States, but North American market for renewable energy. Clean Focus is a, I would say, medium to large size developer, owner, operator of solar, to CNI solar, to put it simply, in the solar power world rankings of developers, and that just came out last week. We are actually the number one commercial developer in the United States in terms of megawatts installed, in their life, if you will. We have over 250 megawatts of operating projects. Almost all of it is in broadly the CNI space, which is maybe threefold. One is traditionally is called MUSH, which is the municipalities, universities, schools, and hospitals. And that for us is primarily municipalities and schools. The second area where we have a large presence is behind the meter rooftop installations for broadly, I'd call it enterprises, standalone retail, manufacturing companies, light manufacturing, typically. And warehouses, distribution centers, things like that. Significant installations at several large, what would be the big box stores, the Walmarts, Targets. We've got several systems on Amazon distribution centers, things like that. And then the third area that we have some focus and concentration would be community solar and what I would say, and we kind of put these in the same bucket, community solar and small electric co-ops. They're structure-wise in terms of our business is very similar kind of scenario where we are, there's very often sourcing agencies or aggregators who, will procure the power and distribute it appropriately to the various members or small rural co-ops and things like that. So those are the three areas we kind of focus on, and I would say we sort of are approximately equal in all three of those spaces. So, to kind of shift into the finance side of stuff, as I said, generally own and operate the majority of our assets. We would be what is, called the sponsor equity. So we put up a lot of the money, but not all of it. We will bring in third-party tax equity to banks and or insurance companies that can monetize the tax credits and the accelerated depreciation benefits that are in place. And we kind of structure the deals typically in two ways, either as a sale leaseback or what is known as a partnership flip. So for the first 5 to 7 years, the tax equity investors take the majority of the financial benefits out of it. And then for the long-term ownership of it, the sponsor equity does, and you also typically use debt on these projects as well. So there's kind of three blocks to the financial stack that most of our projects fall under. Depending on the creditworthiness of the offtaker and or kind of the structure of the deal, The amounts in each section varies a little bit. Tax equity will typically be in the range of 30 to 35% of the total capital. Debt will be another 30 to 35%, and then the straight equity is the remaining portion, which again adds up in the range of around 30 to 35%. So kind of going more towards the what do we see changing out there, or what are kind of some of the big picture trends in this in the financing in this space? It's becoming very much, I would say, a mainstream asset, an infrastructure asset that a lot of mainstream investment kind of companies are coming into this space in the last couple of years pretty aggressively in some cases. In the last year, there's been a number of transactions of large, traditional infrastructure investment companies buying portfolios of projects, either from developers who had the portfolio and they just offload the whole portfolio, or they buy projects in a specific geography looking for some concentration, particularly places like Texas and California. There's companies like Brookfield Infrastructure Fund, which is multi-billion-dollar collection of funds that had invested in things like natural gas power plants, but also in some cases toll roads and all kinds of different true infrastructure, power lines and pipelines. And they have moved aggressively into this space in the last year. And the other kind of, I would say, newish trend is there's a lot of, not a lot, a number of large diversified utilities who are investing pretty aggressively in this space as well. And that's both some of the European utilities like Enel or Engie that operate large utilities in Europe, and this is they see as an entry into the United States market without having to worry about the regulation side of stuff or getting becoming a regulated utility. Although in some cases they've also bought regulated utilities, but that was a while back. And then there's some of the U.S.-based utilities are doing this as well through their non-regulated arms. And so National Grid recently announced a big investment of solar infrastructure. Duke has got a fairly large portfolio of operating solar assets, both in and outside of their regulated utility territories. And so it's kind of an interesting space in terms of lots of new money aggressively coming in, which is both good and bad, obviously, for a company like ourselves. It means that in some cases there's really more competition, but it's also driving down prices. It's driving down the cost of capital, I guess, is probably really the right way to say it. So, does that kind of cover it for a good start?
So excellent start. So we have a couple other people on here who might want to contribute to some of this. Paul, do you want to talk a little bit about what's going on with your project or not? Are you there, Paul?
Jeff, is about you and your company. My name's Paul Donick. I'm a serial entrepreneur. My latest venture, New World Energy, but have in the past developed Internet of Things and software for smart buildings and other things for USDOE and California Energy Commission programs with California and others. I'm very much interested in the capital stack of, with particular emphasis, microgrids, which is where we've been focusing. And so we're going to learn a lot more.
Paul, I'm having a really hard time hearing you. Are you on the speakerphone?
It's kind of breaking up.
Yeah, it's breaking up pretty badly.
I'm sorry. I'm
that's
be
better.
At that location. It was. Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's
well, Jeff,
better.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you for the introduction, and I was just on your website. I'm one of the principals of the company called World Energy, and we are in part with a REIT to build grids on focusing on strip malls, which is a sort of unique, as you know from your history. And so the microgrids bought solar storage and cogeneration. And we are slow to get started, but moving along steadily. And I have a great interest in the capital stack, where you have quite a bit of expertise. So I was interested in hearing what you have to say.
Yeah, so you know, microgrids obviously is a pretty broad categorization, you know, in a sense. But if you look at this, you know, some generation source, again, and nowadays typically going to be natural gas or something, you know, maybe renewable energy, solar, some type of storage, you know, whether it's islanded or running in parallel with the grid. There's not, well, obviously it's a much, I would say it's a much smaller market at this point. It's, you know, emerging market. So there's not nearly the number of players, and there's certainly not a lot of the big players in there. Parts of the, you know, again, particularly if you have some traditional kind of generation in there, you may, you know, again, if it's natural gas anyway, you're not going to be able to, there's no tax equity involved with that, or there's no tax benefits. So, you know, you end up having to structure things differently. We have not ever done a full microgrid. We are doing some solar plus storage type of installations now. And, you know, storage, battery storage is eligible for the ITC if it's charged by solar. And so from a stack point of view anyway, it's not wildly different. What we're finding, or what, you know, I would say the hurdles, and I think the microgrid area is going to be even more so along those lines, is how do you value these things long term? And again, if I'm looking at a battery and solar kind of installation, depending on what ISO territory you're in, you know, the batteries sometimes can participate in the capacity markets and or other grid services markets, you know, frequency or voltage stabilization. And so there's the ability to monetize more than just the energy, or, you know, shift the energy from peak solar production time to the evenings where there may be more value. So, you know, how do you start to value those long-term kind of revenue streams when it's still a little unclear how well and how aggressively you can participate into these, you know, ISO wholesale markets? And then related to that, and this is an interesting thing, new information for us, so we're doing some kind of, you know, study of how this is done. About 2 weeks ago now, LADWP out here in California announced they're in the process, they haven't signed it yet because it's got to go to the city council, a PPA for a large solar plus storage installation, basically at record low prices. And the way it's structured, and we're trying to dig into it more, obviously, there is a solar portion of the PPA, and the solar is, the PPA is priced at right about 2 cents per kilowatt hour, $20 per megawatt hour. And then there's an adder for the battery portion of the energy, and I think if I recall, it's 1.35 cents per kilowatt hour. And exactly how that is structured from a financial point of view is sort of a little opaque at this point, maybe is the right way to say it. And so, you know, are these two separate financial contracts with two separate kind of capital stacks and investors on it? Is it one bundled deal that, you know, and do they keep track of when the battery is sourcing versus when the solar is providing the source? And so it's an interesting kind of thing, but what it means to us is that there are investors out there who are willing and able to look at these kind of new structures, infrastructures. You know, again, and I think microgrids falls into this, and as microgrids become a little bit more ubiquitous and the financial you know, the financial benefits of them become more obvious to more investors, I think there's going to be more and more you know, outside investors willing to put money into these things. One of the things I know we were working with a company, this is a little while back, but you know, that was looking or was very much in the you know, in the microgrid space, and their biggest problem at the time is how do you value resiliency? You know, and that's one of the big benefits of a microgrid is, you know, if the power goes out and you can keep operating critical load, whether it's on a strip mall and you know, it's the grocery store keeping their freezers running, or whether it's a hospital, you know, obviously that has actually some regulatory requirements. How do you value that resiliency if, you know, 98% of the time the value is not there because the grids are operating, but that 2% is so valuable, you know, what's the value of it? And I think that's one of the things that from a microgrid perspective that, you know, if we can start to put our hands around that and what is that value of resiliency, then maybe investors will start to, you know, as long as you're able to monetize that value, then investors will come in.
All right.
Those are great points, Jeff.
Yeah. Richard Schwartzke, are you there? Do you want to contribute?
Yeah, hi, Sierra, and hello, Paul,
hi.
And thank you to the presenter on the finance. Yeah, my name is Richard Schwartzke. I'm the founder and executive director of Zero Net Energy Alliance. Hi, Paul. ZNE Alliance is a not-for-profit that is focused on helping communities to get to zero net energy through typically accelerated deployment of renewable energy, building decarbonization, and electrification of transportation. In the finance space, we have been fortunate to be sponsored on a number of projects through the California Energy Commission, and then typically we come up with half or another 100% of the financing on our own side through a variety of means, customer-sited resources, as well as municipalities contributing and the like. The most interesting and perhaps the most promising approach that we're working on right now is trying to follow up with the many cities in California. We're based in California and our focus has been on California. The many cities in California that have now passed so-called climate emergency declarations, which is a fairly broad-based movement actually around the world that involves folks who have really taken a close look at the most recent IPCC report, noted the 10-year time frame for 80% plus decarbonization for advanced economies, really a emphasis on the plus, is required within 10 years to have a two-thirds chance of staying under the 1.5 threshold, and you can argue about that. That's actually very conservative. So a lot of activists and scientists and policymakers are, you know, have read that report and note that that's substantially more accelerated even than the California goals, which are 80% by 2050, which has typically been the most robust goals that previously were in force. So the you know, whether or not one can get technically, economically, and politically to a 10-year 80% decarbonization is definitely an open question. But the important point for this conversation is that municipalities as significant as LA, San Francisco, Hayward, Oakland, Berkeley, Richmond, Palo Alto, and many more to come, and just in California, and I think close to 1,000 around the world, have, London being a notable example, and many others have passed these climate emergency declarations calling for this more accelerated approach. And, you know, the only way to get there to greater acceleration is, of course, with, frankly, a lot of money and or a really heavy regulatory hammer on things like how long you can drive an internal combustion engine vehicle on the roads. The heavy regulatory hammer hasn't come in most places, but there is a possibility of voters and policymakers effectively choosing to invest more in accelerated deployment of renewables, electric vehicle infrastructure, electrification of buildings, and the like, as well as ZNE code for buildings, which is happening in California and elsewhere for new construction, but then expanding that to retrofit. So to finance all of that, one would optimally need effectively some gap financing to take into account everything that the private market is unable or unwilling to finance on that accelerated basis. And notably, in both EV infrastructure and in building electrification, you know, these are very long lead time ROIs. So, you know, you're talking 10 years maybe for EV infrastructure to pay back, and 30 years for some deep decarbonization in buildings where you're really taking on the whole building, the shell, and you know, electrifying the HVAC and the like. So in that case, what we are proposing is a form of climate finance. You could call it green bonds. You could call it anything you want, decarbonization focused, which would, in a relatively rigorous manner, define, you know, the most cost-efficient measures by cost per ton of GHG reduction, and do some polling to determine what, you know, California, these all have to go on the ballot. They all have to be subject to a two-thirds vote. Surprisingly, maybe 85% of transportation infrastructure and school bonds, which are also subject to that two-thirds threshold, do pass in California on a fairly routine basis. Not easy. They usually pass by a couple of percentage points above the two-thirds, but nonetheless, they pass. And so we are working with community organizers and other, you know, stakeholders in the business and civic leadership community to put together bond issues that would be subject to voter approval that would be focused on decarbonization. So they interface with and there's an intersect overlap a bit with traditional transportation infrastructure bonds in some cases, or housing bonds, which are also going to be on the ballot here in California soon. But you know, the trick is that there's, you know, there's a parallel initiative typically to get the next big transportation, aka highway and maybe some rail bonds, on the ballot in, you know, places like LA and the Bay Area. And those, frankly, don't do a lot for decarbonization, if anything. Sometimes they go the opposite direction. And, you know, those are their valuable projects in their own right, but they don't have a positive impact on GHG. So what we're trying to do is essentially intercept those initiatives and rewrite them to be decarbonization focused. So to the extent they involve transportation infrastructure, to emphasize electrification of transportation, public fleets, EV charging, and the like, emphasize accelerated build out of renewables with the local, often the load serving entity is a CCA now in California, and accelerate building decarbonization. So that's what we're up to, and I'll pause there.
All right. Sherry, do you have anything to comment about what's going on in Wisconsin?
Hi, sorry, I had to unmute. you know, I don't right now. We have a court battle that a solar developer has taken on to fight third party or the blocking by We Energies or WEC Energy Group of third party financing. So I would say we're light years behind in terms of supportive funding initiatives or policy initiatives with regard to financing. We're still looking for a free market.
Yeah, I know you guys have been struggling with that for quite a while, just trying to keep that thing moving forward. So, but that's Jerry Grudo, University of Wisconsin. And Peter, go ahead.
I was on mute.
A lot of background noise there. Peter, do you want to contribute to anything that's going on over in Connecticut?
Well, I'm not a financing person, but so this is all interesting to me. I do know a commercial solar developer who is driven a little mad, I think, by the regulatory obstructions to what we're trying to do here in Connecticut and expanding solar and community solar and virtual net metering and preserve net metering. I mean, what I'm hearing is that financing doesn't sound like it's the major stumbling block in decarbonizing and expanding renewable energy. It's, you know, to, my perception is that it's regulatory obstacles and market and the lack of market mechanisms that value the contributions of solar, wind, particularly when paired with batteries. So to the people who know more about this than I do, is that a fair assessment?
Craig, are you there?
I am here, but I missed the question.
The question is financing renewable energy projects really the big problem, or is or are regulatory obstacles and the lack of market mechanisms that value the contributions of renewable energy projects, are those the, really the two big stumbling blocks right now too?
That's a great question. And you know, in my experience, and I've been a renewable energy project developer as well as you know, running the Clean Coalition, a nonprofit who deals with setting up opportunities for you know, local renewables and other DER. The big problems are really around procurement, interconnection, and financing, you know, can be a struggle for sure. But I would say it's you know, it's a secondary, it's in a secondary tier. There's a lot of money that is ready to that is ready to pay for and finance attractive deals, and so the challenge really is getting attractive deals that a normal investor would be willing to put their money into, and that requires there to be the proper policies and market mechanisms.
Jeff, you want to say something about that? And I'll just open it up to anybody ask questions here. Go ahead, Jeff.
So this is Jeff. Yeah, I would broadly say that that's probably true, that financing is not the biggest problem per se, in that there's plenty of money and there seems to be more money coming into the space. Where we start running into problems, and it's sometimes is related to regulatory / policy type of things, and sometimes it's utility interconnection complications, and those really kind of affect things in a couple different ways. One, in some cases, they limit what you can do. There's limits to the size of systems you could put in, or the configuration of systems have to be specified a certain way. But the other thing, obviously, it does is it drives up the cost to get these things built, and at some point the returns just become, we've got the pressure. I mentioned it before. Yeah, LADWP executing a PPA for 2 cents a kilowatt hour for I think it was 200 megawatts of solar. At first pass, those economics just don't work. You just add up the costs and. So who is financing that? Well, obviously the battery is the critical part there, and you start looking at, offsetting right now in California anyway, and I think, in places as solar penetration gets higher anywhere, this is going to be the general case. Midday wholesale energy prices in California are close to zero and in some cases would go negative if they're really allowed to. And so, what you've got to do is if you've got large solar systems, you store it during the day and you discharge in the afternoon and evenings as these wholesale prices are coming up to 4 or 5, in some cases, more than that per kilowatt hour. And so, that's how these projects start to work and how you get them financed. But one of the things, and this is kind of a broad thing, again, in the finance side of stuff, And it relates very strongly to policy, and maybe if we had a crystal ball, it would be an easier thing. But financiers seem to be willing, long-term financiers seem to be willing to effectively break even on the front end of the project. The tax and depreciation benefits and the amount of cash that the system will actually throw off in the first 10 to 15 years under a contracted PPA or something, because that is one trend that's happening is, broadly speaking, PPA terms are getting shorter. So a 20 or 25-year PPA is much more unlikely today than it was, even 3 years ago. But that's beside the point being that, the investors are like, well, if we can just kind of get all of our cash out and get a reasonable, sort of comfort level in the first 10 to 15 years, then we can make the money on the back end, if you will, and, often called the tail, or they'll finance the tail. And this tail is a big, big mystery in many ways of how you do value that tail. And right now, mostly what people do is, well, the wholesale price of energy is projected to be, 2 cents a kilowatt hour or whatever. That solar system will run for another 10 or 15 years. You do a discounted cash flow and it's worth X number of dollars. And that's where you can, that's where they'll make their money, if you will. They'll, get break even by the end of 10 years and then make it on the back end. But that tail is going to be so much affected. The real value of that tail is going to be so much affected by policy and regulation. And, who knows what the energy market's going to look like in 2030 or 2035, much less what the price of energy is going to be. And if you're kind of going back to, I forget the other speaker was saying about the, really, if we need to decarbonize our economy in the next 10 years or 15 years, that's going to have drastic effects on what the energy market looks like. And it might be positive, it might be negative, and, costs may go up, costs may go down. If I'm a financier and I'm looking at what the value of a property is, a solar property is in, 2020 or 2035, it's a wild guess at this point. So, it's an interesting space. It's fun and it's also frustrating, and it's, kind of the wild, wild west reinvented again, over and over again.
This is Sherry. I don't know if this is something the rest of you have, but in Wisconsin, which is, regulated state, one of our utilities, Madison Gas and Electric, actually now two, did something called a renewable energy rider. Is that something that you have? What it is it's the utility. It enables the utility to attract businesses, especially the large businesses that form the Renewable Energy Buyers Alliance. And so, if a business wants to locate here or wants to get 100% of its energy from renewables, they didn't have a way to do that before, and now they will actually enter into an agreement with and build, let's say, a solar field and contract for a fixed period of time with the business. And the first one just went through, and the reason I'm bringing this up is because it's really enabling right now local governments to get large amounts of energy, so to get to those bigger decarbonization goals faster. And so in the city of Middleton, which is just west of Madison, they just got approval to build a 5-megawatt solar field for community solar. And where the RER, the Renewable Energy Rider, came in is that the city of Middleton and the Middleton School District actually entered into an RER with a utility, and they're buying 1.5 megawatts of the 5-megawatt field. So that'll put Middleton at 50% of its city operations on clean energy locally by 2020 when it's built. And the county, Dane County, just is entering into one also with MGE, and they're building an 8-megawatt solar field on the airport. So I don't know if that's going on in other parts of the country, but that is one way that we're seeing movement forward in a regulated state.
Yeah, this is Jeff, just to answer that part of it directly, and then I had a comment to it. That is going on in other places in the country. There are a number of states that have implemented, and in fact, some are highly regulated states and some are less regulated states, but where utilities can add, it's being pursued very aggressively in Virginia, for example, by Dominion, to effectively serve, like you said, large corporate clients who have mandated 100% renewable energy but aren't allowed because of the regulations in the state to either procure directly or the net metering rules are such that they could only really put a smallish system on their own property to offset, you know, their current energy usage. And so it's happening in Florida. It's happening in a lot of different places, and they're structured a little differently in a lot of these different places. Now the editorial comment towards that, it's happening in places like Wisconsin and Virginia because of the very restrictive policies within the state, or you could say the political clout of the utilities within the, you know, the individual public utility commissions. And so, you know, Virginia, for example, Dominion was very aggressively trying to keep out any kind of customer-sited, customer-owned solar. And I know Wisconsin is a similar kind of thing. And so the clean energy riders in some ways are a way for the utilities to have their cake and eat it too. It costs more than what they could procure if they could procure it privately. The utilities make their regulated returns on the solar in many cases if it's structured in that kind of structure, which is the way it is in Florida, where, you know, Florida Power and Light is building, you know, multi-hundred megawatt solar fields and are rate basing it and making a guaranteed return that's above the returns any private investor would put on to a project like that. And so it's in some ways it's a competitive threat as much as it is a nod to, you know, really being committed to procuring significant amounts of green energy for a utility.
I fully agree, and that is what's going on. But at least it's not, at least it's allowing clean energy to be built and in larger sizes than, you know, what a city would do, which is, you know, 500 kilowatts here and 250 on this roof. And, you know, but certainly that's an issue. We had the same thing happen with We Energies that, sued about third party and then created their own program that we call Rent-A-Roof, which I think is also happening around the country. Yeah.
Sure is.
So, yep.
This is Craig. I just wanted to add one thing to my earlier comments and also, kind of playing off some of the other comments after that. With respect to financing, the real challenge in the financing is the tax equity layer. And that's because there are really very few parties that can play the tax equity, play that investor, fulfill that investor tranche. You have to have a pretty rare tax profile, and you also, and including, you need to not only be able to have enough tax liability to monetize the tax credit, which is a straight 30%, you know, off the top of your tax burden, but you also have to be able to efficiently monetize the accelerated depreciation, which is worth, you know, in the same neighborhood as the 30% investment tax credit if you have the proper tax equity investor. So there's a very rare and limited universe of tax equity investors, and they charge for it accordingly, right? They charge you through the nose. Out of all the if you do a renewable energy project or any kind of distributed energy resource project, if you look at who's making all the money out of the deal, the tax equity investors are the ones who are really getting rich, and everybody else is just kind of, you know, getting by. So that's where we need a lot of, you know, if I was to say we need innovation in the, even in the financing realm, we need to resolve the way the tax equity piece works and open that up to a lot more parties, a lot more competition. And, you know, otherwise it's just going to be kind of a game where that rare group of large banks and high net worth individuals that have figured out how to do this, and other, you know, specialized investor groups are going to be making the lion's share of the profit, right? And I don't think anybody really wants that from a societal standpoint.
Yeah, this,
any comments? Yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
It's an interesting point that we don't have a huge amount of difficulty getting the tax equity part of it, but, you know, we've had some long-term tax equity investors that we work with. But Craig is absolutely right. They are the most expensive part of the credit stack. They kind of dictate in many ways sort of the ball field we can play in, and where areas where they're not interested in. The areas that our traditional guys are not interested in, some cases we still go and do the projects, finding some other equity investors. But from a cost perspective and who makes all the money, there's no question that the tax equity guys make the majority of the money up front. And like I said, the other investors are looking at these tails now and, well, what can we make off the scraps that are left, because these are long-lived assets. But, you know, I think, Craig, you're absolutely right that these tax equity guys yield an inordinate amount of power.
Other comments here?
This is Peter. So I'm working on trying to bring community choice aggregation to Connecticut. So that's about all I ever think about now. And I'm just curious, what's the connection between CCA, community choice, and financing? Is it a helpful player? Are they completely separate subjects? Craig, I know that, you know, I follow what the Clean Coalition does all the time. I really admire what you're doing in the realm of community microgrids. But I don't ever hear you talk about community choice. Is that just not a, I know it's an important player in California, but in community microgrids, do they play a role in that in California?
So the CCAs can definitely play a foundational role in community microgrids. And by the way, the Clean Coalition, we work with a lot of CCAs. You know, we've done projects for East Bay Community Energy. We've helped design for Sonoma Clean Power and Marin Clean Energy. We've just designed a feed-in tariff with a dispatchability adder and market responsive pricing mechanisms for City of San Diego in anticipation of the CCA that they're going to launch, sometime hopefully in the not too distant future. So we do a lot of work with CCAs, but we also do a lot of work with utilities. And so we try to be, you know, a neutral party, and community microgrids can be brought forward by whoever is going to ultimately, provide the market mechanisms, the policies and market mechanisms that make the, you know, local renewables and distributed energy resources viable. And CCAs can definitely do that, even though they haven't done a good job of that so far. Almost all CCAs are buying, they're just buying large central generation renewables, and they're playing the price game, right? They're just trying to get the cheapest price and beat the incumbent utility on price, and in terms of percentage of renewables. So that's been the game in California, 99% of the game. We're starting to get some of the leading CCAs like Peninsula Clean Energy and Marin and Sonoma. They're starting to put more focus on local renewables and other DER, and part of that's because they have to, right? The folks who fought to put CCAs in place were basically sold a bill of goods so far, right? They largely were motivated by the fact that we can get a lot of local renewables into that mix. And so far, the local piece of it hasn't really materialized. It can, and it should, and I think in some places at least it will. So that's all good. And the Clean Coalition, we're happy with CCAs, and we work with a lot of them. And you know, to answer your question on CCA and community microgrids specifically, what the CCAs can do is provide the foundation to procure the local renewables and the other distributed energy resources. Like the energy storage, right, and or make sure that there's procurement mechanisms so that, you know, developers can deploy those things and have a viable market mechanism for their economics to work. But at the end of the day, you're still going to need the utility, because CCAs do not, for a full, true community microgrid, you need to be able to utilize the existing distribution grid assets, you know, the feeder lines, et cetera. You need to be able to put advanced distribution management systems, ADMS, like grid isolation switches. ADMS is hardware oriented stuff, you know, upgrades to the distribution grid. And then you also need to put, microgrid solutions at the distribution level, distribution grid level. Those are called distributed energy resource management systems, DERMS. So, you know, those are solutions that the owner of the grid is going to have to be involved, and that means that the incumbent utilities, distribution grid utilities, will have to be a party to community microgrids, you know, to get the full comprehensive set of benefits of community microgrids. The existing utilities will have to play, even if it's in partnership with CCAs that are doing a lot of the, you know, offtake or procurement. I know that was a lot. Nope. Shock anybody.
Yeah. Anybody else comment?
Yeah, this is Jeff. I'll just add a little bit to what Craig was saying. The CCAs, one of the problems, again, if we want to just kind of keep certainly focused towards the finance side, the CCAs have no assets fundamentally. They're quasi-government organizations, or at least sponsored by, you know, local governments, be it county or in some cases city. And so generally from an investor point of view or finance point of view, they aren't deemed as a very creditworthy off-taker. Now that is shifting a little bit, and Marin Clean Energy and now Peninsula Clean Energy have gotten both to the size, and maybe, you know, they've been in place long enough that they actually have a credit rating. Standard & Poor's, I believe Moody's have got credit ratings for both of those, as well as I think Sonoma Clean Power now at this point. So there is some credibility and some more comfort coming in, and I think financiers are realizing that, you know, even without a lot of assets, they have a very strong ability to generate, you know, a lot of cash, because effectively the vast majority of people in their territories, kind of take over the energy, at least the energy portion of that, of their bills. And so it's a good source of revenues that ultimately are cash flow that can fund long-term procurement. And so, you know, I think there's going to be a gradual shift in that space, and the financiers are becoming more and more comfortable with the California CCAs. That being said, I guess, and partially just because it's popped into my head, it's, you know, with the problems we have going on with the big utilities out here and their credit rating and you know, wildfire liabilities and things, you know, all it would take, I can envision, is one CCA to have, you know, serious financial difficulties, and that whole aura of stability may pretty quickly dissolve. So I certainly don't want that to happen. I'm a strong supporter of CCAs, but I can kind of see somewhat the reluctance of investors to get too aggressive with them.
Any comments?
This is Peter again. Since other people are not commenting, so I know that, Craig, you're in California. I don't know where the others are. I'm curious about if any of you, how much you know about the Cape Light Compact and its sister organization, Cape Vineyard Energy Cooperative, which are the only, which is the only multi-municipality CCA in Massachusetts, and it operates quite differently than all the others as a result. And just, you know, the CVEC, Cape Vineyard Electric Cooperative, does help to develop solar projects on the Cape and the Vineyard. Do you have anything to say about those organizations and, yeah, their work?
This is Craig. I don't know anything about it, so that's all I have to say. I hope others have more to say than that.
Yeah. So this is Jeff. One of the things, well, I guess I should have put it in the beginning when I was introducing our company. Our Clean Focus is kind of a if you will, the parent company of a number of smaller companies, or, you know, I guess not even smaller companies, but different. We have different companies within the organization that really do different functions. We have effectively a yield co, which owns and operates the assets after they're built, and we've got a construction company. But we own Green Skies Renewables, which is based in Connecticut, and so that might be a familiar name for some of the people in the Northeast. Green Skies has a very big presence in the Northeast. And Green Skies actually has done projects with Cape Vineyard. And actually, we recently were awarded another solar contract with them to build and own and operate. If I recall, it's 8 or 9 megawatts total. But like you said, it's an interesting organization because they kind of do aggregated buying for a number of, you know, small municipalities, and so it makes it easy for us, or easier for us, because we can deal with one larger system with one organization to kind of do, you know, both negotiations, procurement, all of these type of things, billing, and so those kind of things streamline us. I would streamline things in some ways for us. You know, it adds a level of complication because they do have, you know, their ultimate end users of this have little different requirements and things like that. But, you know, those are things, and we've got the experience now with them that, you know, we enjoy, they are, you know, we're happy to do business with this. And there are similar organizations other places in the country like CVEC, but it's certainly an area we've had some experience.
Hey, Jeff, quick question. It sounds like they're kind of a CCA direct access provider, but maybe they don't actually, they're not the actual off-taker. So are they more of a facilitator, and your credit, you know, diligence is based on the actual municipality or whoever the off-taker of the energy you generate will be?
Yeah, generally, I would say that's a good way to characterize it, that they, you know, they're an aggregator in a sense, or, you know, they're sort of an agency that helps these smaller municipalities or co-ops that, you know, don't have the infrastructure nor expertise to really, you know, do a efficient procurement. But ultimately, the credit and the offtake is the municipalities themselves. So they're how these things are evaluated from a financial perspective.
Cool. It sounds like one of the big benefits of that type of organization is to do some of the heavy lifting, getting the municipalities and whatever other entities are going to be, you know, partnered in that group, to actually understand that they want, you know, and need, and will actually move forward with procuring renewables and potentially other DER. Is that maybe one of the bigger benefits? And then hopefully they also help to standardize the contracts so that you don't have to go through a completely new set of negotiations and you know, ultimate end contracts, you know, to seal the deals.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is, in the sense of their, you know, it's a efficiency for, you know, some of these are small municipal utility or in Massachusetts light districts, they call them, you know, that are probably don't have populations of more than a few thousand people, and they have a city, you know, owned and operated electric utility. There's no way a city like that can easily understand the complexities of this stuff. And so, you know, they kind of serve as a central source of both, you know, skill and expertise and efficiency in terms of dealing with companies like us, who can have this. We don't have to deal with, you know, 8 or 10 or 12, you know, individual cities. We can just deal with the CIVIC organization and you know, really deliver more efficiently to them.
Anybody else? Okay. Well, we can end it here. There's only a couple more minutes left. And we have a couple conference calls coming up in August. And looking at developing renewable energy projects and opportunity zones. Patrick was going to do that. I'm not sure he's going to be able to. I'll have to find out how he's doing. He was going to be on this panel today as well, Patrick Morand from Duane Moores, and he has some health problems, and we're not sure how that's going to turn out, but I hope it's okay for him. And then the webinar next week is also canceled because he wasn't able to participate in that health issues. The next one, August 7th, is going to be solar saturation and the microgrid approach, distributed rooftop solar on existing utility feeder, achieving saturation levels on deployments far in excess of typical host capacity limitations. Shalom Flank is on that. And Jeff, I think you're on that again too, right?
I think so, yep.
Yep, and then John Walter from California is also a developer out there, Repower YOLO. So hope to see you all then, and you'll be. Forgive me for the massive amounts of emails, of the technology I'm using right now, and I don't know how you're getting along with that. Craig, I know you use Constant Contact, but it's been a nightmare for me. It's doing weird things. I had an email today from somebody that said they had two different registration forms on the same page. I don't understand this, so I have to look into that and see what's going on. I thought I had it straightened out, and I guess I didn't. So anyhow, forgive me for all the emails. I'm just trying to get these emails regulated here so that people who are used to be on the old service are not getting all the emails from the new service. So anyhow, it won't happen forever, but it's just what we have to do right now. Thanks for coming.
Great.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, great program today. Thank you all. It was really informative.
Yeah, thank you very much. Really informative stuff.
Great. Yep. Thanks, everyone.
Yes, and thanks for everybody for coming. And Jeff, I'd like to talk to you and discuss a webinar on this topic. Obviously, it needs to be in a webinar. Too much really important information. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks. Yeah, I'll call you back here. Thanks, everybody.
So I'm going to be jumping on another call, so either we can talk this afternoon or tomorrow or Thursday.
Okay, that sounds good.
Great.
We'll talk
to
you then. All right, now.
All right, bye.
Yeah, bye. Yeah.